The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Capitalist crap, Metro Radio.
Shut up, Billy.
Spending 20 quid on t-shirts from Vivian West has got nothing to do with capitalism, hmm?
It has to do with homoerotica. Nicked homoerotica, actually. Like it?
Oh, love it. It's like anarchy courtesy of EMI. So rebellious. So St. Martin's School of Art. Excuse me.
Hey, everyone. A new, fresh, hip, happening Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Today we're going to be talking about 1991's Young Soul Rebels, directed by Isaac Julien. But before we do that, let's do this. Send a shout out to, I believe, our first commenter on the website. Woo! Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely our nicest commenter.
But also first.
All those things.
What's that name, Basil?
Abel Morales. Great comment, thank you.
Yes, we appreciate it, and I think your name is great, personally. It sounds like you're a movie character.
Yeah.
And shout out to Adam Underwood for sending us a lot of suggestions for our new logo. We're always looking for new logo suggestions, and he sent us a bunch of them. So shout out to Adam Underwood.
We can now say we appreciate our fans, because we have two of them.
Woo!
Speaking of the website, you can always go on to loosecannons.net, LOOSECANONS.net. That's cannons with one N in the middle and one N at the end. Not cannon like the thing that fires cannonballs, but cannon like the thing that is the true Bible books. Canon as in canonical.
None of those fake Bibles.
It's a... Yeah? Nothing apocryphal. Yep. It's a pun. You listeners may have heard of that before.
Puns.
So yeah, visit the website. Check out our content. We've got 4 videos now, at least, when this comes out. And several writings, of course. And all the podcasts you can listen to. But before we delve into today's podcast, let's do a little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements.
It always sounds different.
Mine is the same.
Yeah, you're very consistent.
Patrick's is always different. Mine is always the same.
Yeah,
he's like a real jazz man. Improvising.
Speaking of Patrick, do you have anything you would like to herald or denounce?
You know, I feel weird about heralding this movie because I only gave it 3 stars, but I do kind of want to herald Straight Outta Compton. I thought it was a very good film. It still has most of the same problems that I have with NWA's music in general, but I feel like it's, I don't know. It has some of the best performances that I've seen this year, for sure. You know, I think Jason Mitchell, who plays Eazy-E, is the real revelation for me. Ruben, I know you liked it also. I know you enjoyed Ice Cube's son.
Yeah, I thought O.J. Jackson Jr. was very, very good in it, and he would be my 3rd best male acting performance of the year behind Miles Teller and Oscar Isaac right now.
Nice. Okay, well, part of that I agree with, part of that I don't. But yes, Straight Outta Compton's great. It's in theaters now. I recommend going to see it.
I have not seen it yet, and I won't see it until I get paid for my new job because I'm super broke. I will go ahead and denounce a movie that no one likes, so it really doesn't need me to dogpile on it, but...
I'll still do it.
Yep. That's what I'm here for. It's a movie called For a Good Time Call, which is starring Ari Grainer and... I can't remember her name, but it's Seth Rogen's wife, and she co-wrote the script, and it's a movie about two women who are having some hard times in Manhattan and or Brooklyn, one of the two, and they decide to start a phone sex company to make a bunch of money and, you know, pay their rent and stuff, but it's... very broad, and as many people have pointed out, it also feels like 15 years too late. Like, who cares about phone sex in 2012? And it's really not funny, and it makes me sad because I like Ari Grainer, and I like the idea of a movie that's pretty open and openly critical about, like, gross male sexuality, but... they mostly just, I don't know, play it for broad laughs. You know, dudes call and they have like weird things that they want to request, but it never feels exactly mean-spirited enough to be satirical. It's just more like, here's some gross jokes we thought of and put in here, and I don't know. It was a big bummer. I don't know why I was still watching it for most of the movie, but I finished it, so.
Right. I was mostly rewatching on the weekend, rewatching old stuff. But I guess one movie that I rewatched that I really loved again, but I haven't probably talked about on the podcast yet, was Mirror by Tarkovsky. I rewatched that on the weekend, and it's really blew me away. It was really, really great. I think I have, like, maybe where with other directors I would complain about things like pretentiousness and I don't know, like overly self-involved style. I feel like Tarkovsky earns all of those things by just being so good at them. I feel like, what, for example, like one, I really love the opening of Mirror, which I've heard a lot of people feel is really like confusing or not I don't know, hard to get into. I actually found that the most interesting and the best part of the movie, and I like just not just because it kind of reminded me of certain things, like watching the like the wind and stuff on the on that farmhouse, and like watching the Maria Terekhova sit on that fence and watch that guy come towards her, and then the wind start blowing, and like all this stuff. Was like a really major throwback to like my dacha life when I was a kid in Moscow. But I feel like that scene where the house burns down, the way the camera actually does not show you that house burning for the longest time, just shows you Terekhova coming up to that to get to fetch water, and the camera just stays with her the whole time, and then once she kind of settles in and then like sits back, then it finally tilts upward and shows you that burning house, which obviously took probably forever to like make look as beautiful as it did. I feel like shows you a lot about how just, you know, like he's really in love with his style, but he's also, he kind of earns all the endless praise we people kind of heap on him in those moments. So yeah, I really love that movie.
Me too. I've seen four movies since we last did the podcast. Two of them I liked a lot but didn't love, so they wouldn't quite get the Herald treatment, and they've also both been talked about by Patrick now, Straight Outta Compton and Batman Returns. The third one is Loose Cannons Year One, considering that's a movie that I made about our podcast I'm not going to herald my own work. I don't think you get any more narcissistic than discussing a movie that I made about our podcast. So I will herald the fourth movie I watched, which you've already heard me talk about, so I won't talk about it for very long, which is High and Low, directed by Akira Kurosawa. I rewatched it recently as part of my goal for trying to rewatch and then write about all my five-star movies if I hadn't seen them recently enough to feel like I could comfortably write about them. So I rewatched High and Low, and I moved it up from number 6 on my best of all time list to number 1. I think it's the best film I've ever seen. It is like the... It's become clear to me, partially through watching Kurosawa and just over time, how important blocking is in movies to me personally, and it's the best blocked movie of all time. So it's not super surprising that it's my favorite, but just the way everyone moves in that movie is so expressive and dramatic and tells you so much about what's going on in every single scene when, like, almost nothing else is going on, that it's really cool.
I still want to rewatch it. Because I haven't seen it since I was like 16 years old.
I also think, somewhat relevantly, it's a sly commentary on how police and justice actually work and their extreme biases, which is also cool.
Yeah, I remember watching that, thinking that when I watched it 2 years ago or something. And I really loved that movie for that.
Ooh. Anyways, today we're going to be discussing Young Soul Rebels. As I mentioned previously, this was Ilya's pick, so he will be giving us the plot.
Yep.
Right now.
So the movie's set in 1977, and in London at the time. So it deals with kind of like the disco movement and the punk rock movement in Britain, which in 1977 was like already kind of had like entered a big part of the culture, like the subculture, but had not become like totally mainstream yet. It deals, the main characters are two young men, both DJs that have like a little radio station called Soul Patrol, and one of them's Chris, and one of them is Kaz, and I really wish I remember which one is which right now. But anyway, so I think Chris is the straight guy and Kaz is the gay guy.
That's right.
And in the beginning of the movie, one of their friends gets murdered in a park, which kind of sets into play like this weird little murder mystery, which feels a little bit out of tone with the rest of the movie, which the rest of the movie deals with both of those guys trying to like become kind of like bigger at being either radio or club DJs. One of them tries it through like trying to impress a more popular radio DJ. One of them tries it through buying a lot of stereo equipment and throwing bigger parties. And anyway, the plot seems a little bit more secondary to like just showing the subculture at the time, which I think was Isaac Julian's main point about this movie. So yeah, along the road, there's that murder mystery kind of unfolds, and it you know, it doesn't really matter. I feel like it's definitely not the focus of the movie for me. So yeah, that's the plot.
I was ambivalent to this movie. I really liked the cinematography, and I liked some of the characters, but kind of like Ilya is getting at, the sort of plot of the movie feels really shoehorned in, and there are a couple other parts like that as well, and I found it very distracting, actually, the plot, from what I wanted to watch, and how uncurious I was about that scene and or that whole through line, and how the film didn't even seem particularly invested in it, and it didn't seem to have any sort of overt meaning about the issues that it was dealing with. So that was pretty frustrating for me, considering how much I liked the way the film looked, that I found the plot pretty distracting.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I did not care at all about the murder mystery. I honestly just wanted to... I thought the more interesting story was the relationship between Chris and Kaz, because you get little snippets throughout the movie about their relationship, and it's a very interesting one. And I also like the reversal at the beginning on the audience, where you see Chris dressed in this, what is, I would say, very stereotypically, like, gay club attire, where he's got the little, like, kerchief around his neck, and he's got, like, the see-through shirt on. You're like, oh, these two dudes are gay. And then it's just like, oh, no, he's not gay. He's straight. And I thought that was a good, like, reversal on the audience. Like, haha, gotcha. Your biases were taking you somewhere else. But the movie didn't do nearly enough of that for me. It wasn't playful as much like that. And I wish it had been. I wish it had done more stuff where... I like the scenes where it's just one of the guys, like, walking by and there's somebody, like, sitting on a wall just, like, talking shit to them. I enjoyed the scenes where guys were just, like, shit-talking each other. That was actually pretty fun. But the whole murder mystery that culminates in the big fire at the end, at the big neighborhood party, is just there weren't any stakes that I felt invested in it. I was just kind of like, I don't really care what happens at this point, honestly.
Right.
Yeah, I felt pretty much the same way, except I think I felt a little more negatively than Patrick or Ruben did. There was very little that I actually liked about this movie. I didn't like Chris and Kaz's performances very much. They seem very broad and very, like, kind of overacting, and I didn't really like the writing. Like, all the comments on racism and stuff like that seemed very obvious, and just, like, the cops are really awful, and almost every white person in the movie is just, like, an awful person. And I'm like, okay, I get it, but, like, it's so sort of one note that it got very sort of boring and draggy for me. And then, like everyone else, I didn't care about the murder mystery. I figured out who the killer was almost immediately, because there's, like, we find out that it's a white guy during the thing, and I was like, there's only, like, three white guys in this movie. And so it's got to be, like, the nice one, since the other two are, like, actively hostile. So I was like, yeah, it's got to be the nice guy. And I was right.
I did think it was Paul, the Paul Reiser lookalike, for the longest time.
He was the nice white guy.
Well, no, I meant, like, they set him up to be, he's like the red herring right at the beginning, though, because he's like, isn't it hot to be making out in this graveyard?
Yeah.
Where your friend was just murdered.
Yeah, I feel like that guy got made fun of a lot for all the right reasons. I would agree with all of you in some ways. Like I already mentioned, I really didn't care about most of what was going on plot-wise, but I did really like a lot which had to do with just showing the subcultures. At the time, I felt like the movie had a lot of interesting stuff going on, where a lot of times the people seemed like they were dressed more like the 90s than like the 70s, actually. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was probably Julian's way of just kind of like commenting on how things are sort of the same now. And there's not been much progression in the sense of, like, like minorities and other cultures coming more together or agreeing with each other more. I feel like the movie was at its best when it actually, I think, like, there's a 10-minute stretch where they just show Chris and Kaz playing at this club. And I really enjoyed all of that a lot. I really enjoyed the music. It's really my kind of music. And I also feel like this movie really expressed what I feel about, you know, disco music, in the sense of, like, that is also a music that can be subversive and used as a representation of a minority class, perhaps even better than punk rock was at the time. as it also included more feminine or traditionally gender feminine representations, as well as black and all other non-white groups, but also just by virtue of being a type of culture would also include white people in it, just because white people can feel free to enter any culture they want to. And I feel like that scene in the club got at it really well without spelling it out in a dialogue fashion, just by showing people dancing and hanging out and like rubbing shoulders together. And I feel like I rarely see a scene depicting people dancing that feels the way that I know, or like I think that that's what it's really like. You know, I feel like this movie seemed way more like parties that I've been to than any other movie I've watched that's shown parties, where it's usually just some panoramic shot over like a thousands of
even
people.
Thank God it's Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
even that sadly.
In the movies, the music is usually like front and center on the soundtrack, and you can't hear anything else. And in this movie, when they're showing that club shot, there you can hear like all the people like moving around, and the music is kind of secondary. And I liked that sound choice, because it was like that's actually more what it would sound like in a club like that. Like you would hear a lot more people like moving around and stuff like that.
I think the beginning kind of made that point in a subtle way as well, when they're like changing the radio stations, when it's just like the shot of like, I guess, London at dawn or something like that, or dusk. And then it's just like a bunch of different radio stations like playing different music, and it's like all these different voices and all these different ideas and all these different loves and hates and whatnot, all just blending together to form the introduction to the film.
Too bad it's not about that.
Yeah.
Because then it cuts right to one of my least favorite tropes ever, which is like when someone gets murdered and it's not from anybody's POV, but it's also not an omnipotent POV because you can't see the killer, but like the person being killed can see the killer. So like who is watching it? It's like there's a god person filming it, but he's like, I'm not going to show you this part. You don't get to see it. Just look at this guy's feet. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, where are we? It makes me so irritated when that happens.
But that guy kind of looked like the wild one from the back. So obviously Isaac Julian has watched Kenneth Anger.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that there's a very Kenneth Anger shot in this movie where they're like putting on their pants and they pull up, they have like the like leather, like one of them has black leather pants, the other one has red leather pants. Gosh, that's hard to say. And they're like zipping up the pants in the front. I was like, this looks exactly like Scorpio Rising. Like, it looks like he pulled it right out of that.
It made me wonder whether in England wearing oversized baseball jerseys was a thing at some point. Doesn't seems very strange.
I was curious about that too. I was like, do they care about baseball?
No, but I mean, that's a fairly typical hip-hop thing. When is this movie supposed to be?
1977. Sort of like
so that was
pre-hip-hop.
That was just before hip-hop really started, yeah.
Hip-hop wasn't even really a thing at that point. It's very... I don't know, though. I obviously wasn't alive in the 70s, so I don't know.
I mean, I think late 70s was the time when there were, like, block parties and stuff like that happening, and there was, but it was not really anything that was sold yet and marketed to like Europe or whatever.
Yeah, and I will say I think those logos, good lord, the logos on the jerseys looked a little more modern than 70s, because I don't think that was the Giants logo in the 70s. It was definitely like a 90s Giants logo.
Yeah.
Well, it would fit with them trying to like use American culture to like represent themselves. I mean, the soul music that they were using, or the disco music that we're using, was also all American bands.
Yeah, for sure.
And like the clothes they were wearing, a lot of them were like also representative of more American culture than British culture, which I think at the time was probably also really staunchly conservative, mostly the core. And I'm not really sure about that, though. I might be wrong about that.
I mean, the sense I got from the movie was that the British establishment was pretty conservative, because it was all like every other shot you saw of somebody in like the, I guess like the mainstream in this movie, it was them like getting ready for the Queen's Silver Jubilee, and they were all like,
right, yeah, that's something I forgot during the plot description is actually based around the Queen's Silver Jubilee.
Yeah, which reminded me a lot, like the way that they were celebrating it reminded me a lot of the 4th of July in the United States, and the way that people like, you know, put up the flags everywhere, and it's all about, you know, here it's all about America, and I suppose there it's all about like, you know, Britain, like proper, you know.
Nah, kingdom.
But I did like the scene where Chris storms out of the radio station. He like knocks the, they have that little like mock-up of the Queen like waving, and he just like knocks the Queen's arm down and her arm is just doing like this to the side. I like that little cardboard cutout mock-up. That was a fun prop that sure. they have in the movie.
Yeah, I feel like this movie just has way too much on its plate, because it's like trying to comment on radio and the way that music was changing, and race and sexuality, and have this murder plot, and, you know, like comment on, I guess, like a British class, like caste culture or like caste societies, and, you know, all these different things happening all at the same time. And I feel like there's maybe a way you could weave that all together, but I feel like you would need at least another hour of movie and a better writer.
you could have chopped up like maybe 40% of the plot stuff going on and just had a cool movie about one or the other.
They
tried to make too much of it foreground. And some of it should have been background, I felt.
This movie had an obsession with false tension that I didn't really understand. Yeah. Like, was it trying to make fun of Hollywood movies? Or, like, there's a scene at one point where someone with, like, a welder mask is walking up to somebody, and you think that it's either the murderer or, I don't know, someone bad. There's, like, even bad music playing underneath, and then it's just, like, their friend who works in the auto shop or whatever, like, pulling a prank on them. And then when they're trying to set up the antenna on the roof to broadcast to a wider audience, and who is it? Is it Chris who almost falls off?
Yeah,
he almost falls off the roof.
Yeah, I wrote that down too.
I was like, what is this doing here? And then, like, right after he saves his life, like, they get in a big fight about methods to become more famous, and I'm like, that doesn't seem very realistic to me.
Considering he almost died.
Yeah.
And also the writing in that scene is terrible when they're like yelling at each other. It feels very like a, I don't know, TV drama, like it's time to escalate this thing. Like, I don't know. It reminded me of J.J. Abrams and Lost, where people are just yelling at each other constantly.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Maybe this is where he learned it from.
It's true. J.J. Abrams loves this movie.
I doubt that.
So, The Glass Shield is about Charles Burnett and Catherine Bigelow's friendship. What is the secret story behind Young Soul Rebels?
If only we knew more about Isaac Julian.
It's true.
Yeah. Hard to say, really.
I was going to say, it's a bummer. I feel like we keep picking these movies by black filmmakers that have really promising premises, and then they end up being not very good movies, and it's pretty sad.
So far it's Civil Brand and this being really disappointing. I mean, Glass Shield was all right. It wasn't awful.
I liked the Glass Shield. I've liked most of them, I felt. I liked Glass Shield. I liked Bush Mama. I liked, what was the other one that... I felt like there were some other ones where you guys were like pretty ambivalent, but I was like, yeah.
Civil Brand. You love that one.
yes, by the young black filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson.
One that's not out yet, you liked more than all of us, but it's not out yet, and it's also not a black filmmaker.
It's true.
Yeah. So it's Spike Lee and Isaac Julian's
cool,
friendship.
Cool World? That's not a black filmmaker either, just a black film.
Yeah.
Cool World was also one. Yeah,
Shirley Clarke. Yeah.
And then we did Imitai, but we all liked that.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Everyone
that's
who watched
why.
It.
Yep, I didn't watch it.
And then Civil Brand, and nobody liked that. And then Ganja and Hess, and we were mostly in the middle on that, I think.
Yeah.
I think I gave it 3.5, and I might have been the high score.
Maybe.
And then A Rage in Harlem we were divided on. If I remember correctly, Patrick and I didn't like it very much, and Ilya and Basil did.
Yeah.
Although I didn't love it, but...
Yeah.
But I mostly meant, like, the ones that I hadn't really heard of. Like, I'd never heard of this movie before Ilya picked it, and I never heard of Civil Brand before you picked it, and I was like, those both sound like awesome movies, and then watch them and they're not awesome. And that bummed me out.
I'm still kind of excited about Isaac Julian because I like the way that this movie looks. But...
Did he make other movies?
Well, he made
He made Looking for Langston,
yeah, exactly.
Which I'm really excited to see.
Oh, yeah.
About...
I mean, that was one of the reasons why I put this movie on here when I saw that he also made like Looking for Langston, because I figured he might be someone who's really interesting who deals with these kind of issues. And I mean, this is also the kind of thing that is not really easy to put across in film. Like
Looking for Langston is a Sally Jane Black favorite.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, so that should
promising.
Be
strong, Rick.
Should That's be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's promising. We've had some good ones from Sally. We've had Blood Spattered Bride is another one. That was our favorite that really enjoyed.
I feel like the worst thing about the murder plot in this movie is it really also really dumbs down and it actually plays into like typical stereotypes about like gay subculture. Like, oh yeah, it's dangerous and people are murderous and you meet in these trashy locations and like you it's always like young people getting murdered and whatever, like and then they're all like psychos and blah blah blah. Like I really hate that, especially for a movie that actually tries to like get into like or like the day-to-day sometimes of like black gay teenagers and whatever. Like how can it be doing that and at the same time basically like treating that's one of its major subplot as like gay panic, you know? Like, it's really
yeah. It made me wonder whether or not, yeah. like, in order to get the movie made, he had to pitch it like a kind of like modern take on Cruising or something. Cause
yeah,
it definitely has that vibe a little bit in the beginning and with the murder stuff, but like that they wanted it to be more seedy than. And also, maybe he just really likes Brian De Palma. There's a lot of stuff that's very, very much just like a ripoff of Blowout where they like keep listening to the tape over and over again. And...
Yeah, I didn't understand. There were some really concrete details on him listening.
Is that
to
how
the
recorders
tape?
Work? Like, they just record the sound coming out of the speakers so
that,
on, with a microphone?
I don't understand like what that recorder was.
I'm pretty sure in that type of boombox you would have had to plug in a microphone to record anything other than the stereo channel you're on.
Yeah,
I would think so too, but who knows? That's weird.
It's true. Maybe in this 1977, I didn't even know that tapes existed that long ago. They like tape players.
Yeah, there's some concrete details like that are just unclear in this movie. Like the first time that Chris listens to the tape, it doesn't seem like it really registers with him like what it is. He's just like, it seems like he's just playing it back because he wants to record over it to do his radio bit. And I was like, did he record over it or what? It just like cuts away from it, like doesn't give you any answers. And you're just like, that's a really concrete detail that's important to the story. And now I don't know what the fuck's going on. Why, you know?
I mean, maybe it was studio interference and he was just like, okay, let's just screw this whole subplot up really badly. So
yeah, that would be my guess, but I feel like the problem is that he didn't put enough attention into screwing it up in interesting or fun ways.
I'd agree with that, yeah.
Like, what he did was just lazy instead, which, you know, I don't want to do things that I don't want to do, but then I don't release them to the world.
Yeah. And there are scenes outside of that sort of seem very strange and sort of like they aren't going anywhere. One of them that I wrote down is when they go to that club where the Sylvester song is playing.
Yeah.
And everyone's like really rude to him. And I was just like, is this just like, they're like, we need more people being racist in this movie. Like, I was like, I kind of got it. Like, all the white people in this movie are racist, but like, why is this scene? Because they just get mad and then leave the club and that's the end of it.
Well, this time a gay person was racist. So it was like, you know, it's like racism is in every culture, which I think is a valid point to make, you know? Like, sure. I'm pretty sure gay culture is also pretty, like, knowing the kind of club culture that was going on in the U.S. at the time was also pretty exclusive and very racist as well. So it's definitely a point that's worth making. It's just, it feels like you said, like a point that's already been hammered home to a point where it just doesn't even register as something worth mentioning.
Yeah, and just that, like, that's the only purpose it serves. I feel like a good writer could make a scene that has that moment in it, but it's also forwarding all the other plots that are going on, which it doesn't, because he just gets mad and leaves, and that's the end of the scene. And I'm like, well, okay, I guess. Like,
yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. That's true.
I wrote down music cuts are awkward, and I don't know whether that means when the music cuts in the film abruptly at weird points, or if there are video cuts during music that are, they try to bridge weird video cuts with music, but it doesn't work. But one of those two things. Mm. Just so you know.
They could both be equally true, maybe. It's a Schrodinger's criticism. You'll never know.
Yeah, I mean, I also have to say, even though I love the soundtrack a lot, I'm not sure it was used, like, in the best possible way. Like, this movie does not really feel very rhythmic, even though it deals with two DJs playing music all the time. For that, it feels like an awfully kind of, I don't know, not very flowing movie.
Yeah,
if you're a young filmmaker looking for some advice on how to use music in film, watch Loose Cannon's video analysis part 3, Music,
Oops.
On our website.
Yeah. I
it was a hell of a segue.
Yeah. I will say that I was into that opening sequence where it was like you know, they were using the Parliament song as the opening, and I thought it was going to keep going from there, but then it like starts cutting around, and I understand. I think Ruben said earlier it was like trying to get all the voices in there, and it was like all these different styles coming together, but I felt like it interrupted the flow of that opening, and I kind of was just like, oh, I'm not really that into this anymore, since you just kind of like, you know, shoved all this other stuff at me real quick, and I'm not as into it. And I don't know, I felt like this movie could have, I felt like if some of the scenes had been longer, like if they had been a little bit more free-flowing, it would have made it more interesting to me. Like I would have enjoyed a much longer club scene or a longer scene where they're, I like the scene where he, in particular, where he's showing the girls how to dance in the park. And maybe if that hadn't just been there to like serve a plot point where it's like, oh, they found this boombox, like that seemed like that was the only point of that scene. And I was like, I wish you had just done a scene where he was just like showing people how to dance. And it's like the ending, like I enjoy kind of like watching the characters dance over the end credits or whatever, and I thought that's kind of fun. But again,
like in the remake of Footloose starring Miles Teller.
God, no.
I really want to see that.
There's a scene where they teach the little girls, or where the little girls teach him how to dance.
Right, right. Which is also in the original. They teach the character how to dance, I think. Don't they?
Yeah, but there's no little girls.
Oh, well.
That's the difference.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, there's just a Kevin Bacon, I don't know that... Pin? What is the name of that actor?
Chris...
Montage?
Is it Chris Pin?
Chris Pin. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah! I remember that now.
Mm-hmm. That's you know. Anyway, what was I talking about? Yeah. This movie.
Not enough Kenny Loggins in this movie. Obviously,
that's true. That's a complaint I could level at almost any movie.
Not enough Donna Summer. They talk about Donna Summer, but they don't ever play any.
It probably cost too much to license her songs.
Probably, yeah. which is unfortunate.
Well, they should have just had her be an actress who can't sing.
Yes,
and exactly.
And then suddenly she can sing.
Yeah, yeah.
Deliver an Oscar-winning song.
Perfect, perfect.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke that if you want a movie with some long scenes that investigate 70s subculture, might I recommend Boogie Nights?
No, thank you.
I would recommend Basil's writing on Boogie Nights, though.
Right on.
Available on loosecannons.net.
Under the writings tab.
Our segments are Boogie just Nights. Like these weird Ouroboros. We're just like back around.
Well, I think we've once again run into a movie that we don't have too much to talk about. So yeah. It's
I feel like we can make just like 90-minute promos for our website. That's okay.
I wrote, they look ready to eat the music, which is a note that I look really like, but I'm not exactly sure what it is in reference to.
Is that when they're talking about the new records that they got? Like, they're, like, looking at them like, oh, wow, this is the new, you know, like, the new Donna Summer.
Maybe. It's after the Wild One scene, but my note after that is patriotic listeners, patriotic in quotes, because I think someone said that, and I thought it was funny. Mm.
I do not know. I think it's been the longest for me since I've seen the movie because I rented this at the video store at the same time that I rented Not at the Lips, and so I had to watch it before I could return it. And then the podcast got pushed back a little bit, which is fine. But I did write down two things that I thought were super funny in a like bad way, in that they're the thing that always happens, and one of them is like the classic party cut where people are like having a really good time at a party, and then it cuts to them after the party is over, like falling out into the streets and like laughing and being like, ah, like we just had an amazing night together, woo! And the other was, there's a shot pretty late in the movie where the guy like looks up at the sky and is like shouting at the heavens, and the camera kind of cranes up to like look down at him, which is always a funny shot to me. My favorite use of that is in the end of
Shawshank Redemption?
No, although that's a good one too. My favorite one is Pay It Forward. Pay It Forward. When I was a kid, I watched Pay It Forward, and I laughed so hard at the very end of it. I'm going to spoil it for any of you listeners who haven't seen Pay It Forward and are really looking forward to it. But
Haley Joel Osment's career gets stabbed at the end.
Yep. Yeah, there's a bully that's been bullying this kid all the whole movie, and then Haley Joel Osment finally steps up to him and gets stabbed by the bully, and he like falls to his knees with like the knife in his stomach, and he looks up at the sky, and the camera's over him, and it's like this really melodramatic music.
Wow.
And like the stabbing's so silly, and then like you just find out that the reason Paying It Forward got started is that Haley Joel Osment has been dead the whole movie. And
Jesus.
Why is Haley Joel Osment always in movies where people have been dead the whole time?
True.
Yeah, whoever was his agent at the time wasn't like had some weird choices.
Yep. I hope that's the twist for Sex Ed that came out last year.
Oh God, no, that movie's awful.
I know.
If only he had been dead that whole time. Only the director of that movie had been dead.
No, thank you. I like lighting/dancing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a shot from inside the car that I like. I thought it was funny when the guy said that he was just trying to give him some professional advice, and by professional he meant racist.
Yeah.
It's pretty on the nose, but I like when he knocks the animatronic queen's waving hand off its regular thing, and then it's like waving downwards like a broken arm.
Patrick mentioned that already.
Yes, yes, okay. I did.
Did he mention it while I was restarting my computer?
No, you were just looking at something on your... I don't know.
He's just
maybe
not
listening. I don't know. We're not accusing you of anything.
How did you like the sex scene between K Kaz and the white guy to set to Sylvester's Mighty Reel. Mm. I actually thought that, in theory, I would totally love this, but I kind of didn't really love it because I really didn't care about their relationship at all. I thought, like, Kaz was much cooler than I don't remember what the white guy's name is, the one who looks like Paul Reiser.
Yeah.
Paul Reiser.
He's a really weird character. Like, is the point that he's like, yeah, you know, that punks were like really insecure and sensitive? Because anytime anyone says anything like even remotely rude to him, he gets like really upset and just like quiet and walks away. And I'm like, I mean, what is this trying to say about like punk culture or something? Like,
white people are super sensitive.
Yeah, I guess.
And they cannot handle being Ellis.
That's fair enough.
I don't know if that's really what this film was trying to say. I think that's what Straight Outta Compton was trying to say.
That's a pretty good thing to say.
White people are only allies until their feelings get hurt, and then they take their ball and go home.
It feels very relevant with the Bernie Sanders thing going on.
Yep.
I totally supported you until you did that thing that I didn't like that much. Yeah. Now we're done here.
Like, the moment just before that sex scene, I think the white guy is somewhere like getting into a fight or something like that with people where you really shouldn't be, or he's like trying to hand people flyers that really don't want them, and he's just like provoking people just because he's white and thinks that he's invincible and nothing will ever happen to him and he's gonna be fine either way. And then Kaz kind of like drags him by the ear and tells him that he should stop being a moron, which I felt was a good scene. And the scene before that, when Chris's girlfriend makes fun of his shirt, that was a pretty great scene. Anything that made fun of that guy was pretty cool. Actually, although, like, in the beginning I feel like he's just standing there and he's like hot and like, you know, so it didn't really feel like he had much of a character to begin with, and then he just ends up being like a punching bag for people, to make Isaac Julian's points that much more salient.
As far as queer interracial sex scenes go, I'll take the watermelon woman over this one.
Yep,
I agree with that.
Still have not seen that.
It's a good movie. Way better than this one.
Yeah.
I like that movie a lot.
I figured out the other movie that I think I liked, but everybody else was ambivalent on. I think it was One False Move. It's probably the like filmmaker film that I enjoyed, but everybody else was kind of like, meh.
Yeah. That movie was fun to talk about, though.
Yeah, that was a good combo. Good podcast, unlike this one.
Get up.
Yeah.
And now we cut to the False Move podcast.
I feel like whenever a podcast isn't that great, we should just cut and then just insert some of the other good podcasts that we've done. Just, why are you listening to this? Listen to that other one. That was better.
I've heard most of the Margaret podcast 4 times now. They keep putting it in the other podcast.
Are we really listening to God of Thunder again?
Oh yeah, I thought the part nice. I thought the part where he's trying to teach the kids to dance was really funny because he seemed like a really bad dancer, and it felt like the blind leading the blind on that one. Like, I don't know. Having just rewatched Damsels in Distress and realizing, wow, Greta Gerwig's a really good dancer. Like, it really puts it in perspective when an actor is supposed to be a good dancer and they're not really pulling it off.
Like Kevin Bacon in the movie Footloose.
Yeah, where they just subbed him for a body double during all the really intense dancing parts.
Yep. Like, the only dancing move he does is, like, the splits or something. That's about it.
That's still not easy.
No.
I really like the Wikipedia line about the summary of this movie at the end, saying the final scenes with the main characters cleaning the records, the reconciliation of the two DJ buddies, and the one by one each of the friends joining in to dance together is very life affirming.
Nice.
I like that a lot. It's like, it feels like the most like clinically awful description of something that's supposed to be really emotional, which is how kind of how I felt about the ending of this movie, actually.
Yeah, I thought they were all bad dancers during that part too, but
well, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like you can show people being bad dancers and that's okay if the movie kind of gets you into a
just like the Shake It Off video.
Yeah.
Directed by Mark Romanek.
Well, there it's only Taylor Swift being a bad dancer.
That's true.
Which is hilarious because Taylor Swift is a terrible dancer. In fact, there's a whole like Tumblr or blog dedicated to Taylor Swift dancing awkwardly, and it's pretty amazing.
I still haven't seen that video, actually, so I feel...
Basically, the majority of the video is extremely professional dancers dancing really well in front of Taylor Swift while she's dressed up similar to them dancing really poorly.
Which I feel like is a fun way to, I guess, like poke fun at your detractors and be like, I don't care if I'm a bad dancer, I'm just enjoying dancing.
But. Yeah. I'm trying to think of like movie scenes with bad dancing that I liked in it, but I think most movie scenes have
the one that comes
dancing
to mind immediately for me was Frances Ha, because that's somebody who is a good dancer dancing badly on purpose.
Oh yeah, The Last Days of Disco has plenty of bad dancing.
Yeah, it does.
It's actually a movie about characters who can't dance at all, constantly hanging out at a club, so there's plenty of that.
It's a fun movie.
It is a fun movie. It's
with Stillman. Cool guy.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
Should we mention his other movies as well? We've mentioned two of them.
It's true. Barcelona. Mm. Just say them out loud. Metropolitan.
Metropolitan.
Classic.
Oh, yeah.
Good times.
I thought it was really weird how the guy dies. He just like falls into the ground and then burns to death.
It was super weird.
He can't have fallen that far. Like, that stage is like 2 feet high.
You and your obsession with how far it is to fall from stages.
You always have these stages that are so low to the ground. It's like you wouldn't be hurt if you fell that far. You would just get right back up if you just fell. He falls out, it's like, ah! It's like, where did he go? Is there a pit beneath?
You must really love that scene in Spider-Man 2 when Aunt May is like holding on to the umbrella. It seems like she's gonna fall, and then like she just falls like a half a foot to the ledge that's just below her. She's like, oh, thank you.
It's a great gag. I like that joke a lot.
I don't have any other notes. I thought the acting was pretty poor for the most part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris was definitely over the top. He
put
that on the director.
Like I said, I thought the cinematography was good, but not so much of the rest of it. I wanted to like this movie more than I did.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
But I didn't.
It's too bad. It's too bad.
It's true. Maybe the next one will pull it around.
Well, so far we watched two movies vaguely about disco, or like sort of pretty much about disco that I both didn't like, but at least you liked one of them.
I liked one of them.
Yeah.
Just me. In fact, I was going to give that one 4.5 stars before y'all convinced me to drop it to 4. Which is fine. That happens sometimes on the podcast both ways.
That's what we do.
Yeah, it happens both
ways.
Make
people
like
things less.
Y'all convinced me to give Wendy and Lucy 3 stars when I was going to give it 2.5, so. I like
that.
I like changing my mind.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've raised or lowered at least a half a star in a lot of these. Or I'm just like,
I've never raised or dropped anything a whole star, but I've changed things half a star a lot. Watermelon Woman I raised, Wind Rises I raised, Possession, and Thank God It's Friday I dropped.
I raised Not on the Lips, although not exactly because of the podcast. When I was going back through the movie to get screenshots, I was like, oh, this is a pretty cool movie, actually.
See, I told ya.
It does look good.
Yeah, I got some fun screenshots from it.
Alright, well, anyway, I feel like we're up our discussion
Young Soul Rebels.
Yeah. This does have a cool title that doesn't really have anything to do with the movie.
Yeah.
Honestly, it isn't. I don't know. I guess they are rebelling against something, but you don't ever really get a
They're
good
playing
sense.
Soul, and they're young.
They are playing Soul. But I don't know. I didn't feel like they were rebelling against that.
I think the movie really tried to make the title as literal, like as applicable as possible. So got to make sure I got some young people playing some soul music, and they're not,
Yeah,
not,
I wish they
not
was
walking
more
the straight line.
In this movie, honestly,
that's true.
Or they were younger, like they were like 13-year-olds who played soul music.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
Their voices are cracking on the radio. Thanks for listening.
This is the Parliament Funkadelic. WEFUNK, we funk.
Is that how 13-year-olds sound?
Sometimes.
I did for very brief points. I think I was a little younger than that, more like 12, but when my voice was cracking, I did a lot of that, and it was very embarrassing.
According to Bobby Brady on the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, I was a lot like that. That one kid in The Simpsons who always plays like the sad, like
Ralph?
No, the one who's play. He's like an extra, but he's always like the cashier at the like burger restaurant, or like he has like the pimply faced kid. My voice is
welcome to Krusty Burger.
I think he's the one that's running the paint mixer when Bart goes to put the beer can in the paint mixer. They're giving out free acne cream out front. Oh!
Oh, man, I hate teenagers.
They're the worst.
Take that, teens.
That's a lie. I like teenage... and I like their movies about them, like Twilight.
That's true.
Say anything.
You gotta give it up for the teens, yeah. Man. It's tough for the teens out there.
Follow us on Twitter, teens. We don't have a Twitter account, but follow us.
I can make us a Twitter account. It takes like 2 seconds.
Sure does.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you are enjoying the podcast. As always, you should subscribe to us using your podcast listening application. And if you get a chance, go to a computer, create an iTunes account if you don't already have one, and give us a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. And of course, you can comment directly on our website using the Discuss feature, as Abel Morales did. Or you can always send us emails at loosecannonspodcast, LOOSECANONS, podcast at gmail.com, as Adam Underwood did.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Boom.
Okay.
Great
Bye.
Stuff.
Bye.
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 That was our worst time to buy ever.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, bye, bye.
Bye,
bye, bye, bye, bye, bye.
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 Bye. All right.
Auf Wiedersehen, good night.
All right, bye. Okay.